Okay, so where are we now, Mr.?
Mr. Miracle. We're in the 20th floor of the spaceship.
Of the spaceship.
After like 19, it becomes a spaceship, and you go, and we're docked in the spaceship. You have to edit out that address.
No, it's
people,
okay.
You want people coming sightseeing in the spaceship. Taking a tour of the spaceship.
Listen, I've got aliens protecting us here.
Yeah, well, that's true. You've got a whole fleet of aliens kind of making sure no one comes up.
Well, I know. So talking about aliens, what were you saying?
Well, I've known many aliens in my flights and in my travels, especially at my own personal spaceship. I've got a spaceship twice the size of yours. Got it fully staffed, you know. And I was just talking earlier to our friend, our man on the street, Gio, about one of the more memorable aliens who shall go unnamed to deter the litigious, who was a real piece of work. And you don't want to necessarily say that with any kind of spite or piss or vinegar, or, you know, because these people are sick that we talk about. But some are sicker than others, and some... What I was saying earlier about this particular gentleman, who we'll call Ralph.
Okay, Ralph. That sounds good. That's a good makeup name.
Good. Is that sometimes when people get sick, they become real problematic, and they become assholes. Well, this guy was an asshole before he got sick, and whenever he was well, he was an asshole. But there were moments when he was kind, but it was always like a calculated kindness. You know, I personally could always see, after enduring his tantrums, I could always see behind the kindness that there was something behind it, that he was using it. He was very, very, very crafty, very, very slick in his insanity. But make no mistake, he was totally insane, Ralph. Totally insane.
Now, Ralph, you spent how long?
5 years, about 4.5 years on the wards with him, on a particular ward with him. I'd heard horror stories about him. I knew him from a distance, and he's got a little bit of notoriety in the hospital as the guy who does all this crazy stuff. So I said, wow, he's wild. So Ralph would always come in to use our phone to call his mother and curse his mother out. I want you down here at 3 o'clock for visiting time. Cocksucker, motherfucker. You didn't come yesterday. And when you came last week, you brought the wrong shirt. Cocksucker, motherfucker. I want you down here. If you don't come down here, I'm going to kill you. You hear me? His mother would respond to that, you know? And she'd be down there at 3 o'clock. Not out of fear, but just because he understood that he was sick. And that was his way of communicating to her. Then he'd go into his, come on, Ma. Come on, you know I didn't mean that, Ma. I'm sick. I'm sick, Ma. I'm sick. You know that. I'm sick. I didn't mean that. Come down, Ma. And bring some pizza. And a couple of shirts. And a Walkman. A cassette Walkman. I don't like the Discmans. I don't like the CDs. Cassettes, Ma. I'm sick. You know that. I made in my pants today, Ma. I made in my pants. I'm only human, Ma. I'm only human. And then, you know, that's how we'd end his call. He'd give her a good dose of terrorism. And ended with the Ralph that she knew and loved, her little baby. So seeing as she was in her 80s, she'd make the trip to come down from deep in the hearts of Queens, where not too far from where I grew up, actually. A little further out in the white Italian area. But which was made famous, actually, in the early 80s, that part of Queens, for fighting the influx of black people moving into the neighborhood. I remember seeing on the news. The whites did not want the blacks moving further into that part of Queens. So it's famous in my mind as being a very racist Italian, German, predominantly Italian American, but also Germans and Irish, keep the niggas out area. And he gave me a good dose of that himself. Whenever anything went wrong, whenever I defied him and got to a point where it escalated, the first word I was, nigga! You fucking donkey, mooly, you moulion, you fucking cocksucker, fuck you and your peanut butter, fuck you and your peanut butter. You know, just, okay, well, thank you.
Well, what's the peanut butter?
He always saw me coming out whenever I would come out of my room, because I would stay in my room mainly because I could get access to my room, because the staff liked me, and also to stay away from people like him. Of which I had 24 other people like that to deal with. So, of course, you'd want to stay in your room if you could possibly. But whenever I would come out of my room for change of shift, whenever it's change of shift and you had to step out just to show your face, to show that you were still on the ward, which is like a ritual it became, I'd come out with a little peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And he'd always ask, what do you got? What are you eating there? Bologna? What do you got? Salami there? What do you got? I said, peanut butter and jelly. Peanut butter and jelly. What? Can I get some? I said, no, Ralph, I only have enough for me. Oh, only got enough for you. Huh? Nice guy. Nice guy. Nice guy. Only got enough for you. So after a while of always asking and always being turned down, I was like, you and your fucking peanut butter. So one day he got into my room. I made the mistake of leaving my door open and going to program, and my door was open all day. And him being a bit of a musician, he played mostly saxophone, but he knew a few guitar chords. So him being a bit of a musician, he snuck into my room when I was out at program. I came back, he got into my peanut butter, and opened the jar, and dug his hand, didn't get a fork or spoon or a knife or anything that was available, a dull-edged knife, of course, that was available to that to use. He dug his hands into it, ate it all up, and then proceeds to go into my guitar case and play my guitar with peanut buttery hands. So I come back to an open room, a jar of peanut, empty jar of smeared up peanut butter on the table, and my guitar open with peanut butter all over the neck and the strings. I look down the hall, and I see Ralph left down the hall looking sheepish with peanut butter smeared all over his mouth. So I walk up to him and say, did you get into my room? Yeah, so what? He gets offensive. So what? What the fuck is wrong with you? What the fuck is wrong with me? What the fuck is wrong with you, cocksucker? You cocksucker, what the fuck is... You and your fucking peanut butter. You and your fucking... Okay. So we didn't talk to each other for a month. Which, like I mentioned to you, a month on a ward with people who you're with every day is like a year to not talk to them or not just ignore them. It was a major feud. And I kind of mentioned to you, it's kind of like a marriage where when you're living with somebody and you don't talk to them for a month, it's a long time when you see them all day. And you can go to your program and come back and go and come back. But when they're on the weekends, like Friday to Monday, and they're in your face and you're not talking to them and you're ignoring them when you once were best friends, and the tension, you can feel it. Much like a marriage, which I'm sure you can go into. But somehow, I don't know who broke the ice. He may have broken the ice. I think like after the third week, he'd say hello. How you doing? And then after the end of the third week or into the fourth week, how you doing, Issa? What's up? And then towards the end, he said something, sorry about getting in your room. I was hungry. I'm a sick man. You know that. I'm a sick man. I'm only human. I'm a sick man. I didn't mean. And he apologized. And I'm such a softy that you could rape my wife. Oh, not rape my wife, but you could really do the worst to me. But if you show some sort of contrition, if you kind of say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, I will probably melt, break down and say, okay, I'm sorry. Rather than keep up this wall and just, I do hold grudges. I still hate him with a passion for that peanut butter incident. But I'm also, as much as I hold grudges, I also know that that gives you cancer, basically. So I do hold grudges, but I also kind of release them enough so that I can forgive but not forget kind of thing. I won't forget how he did that. And I knew enough to lock my room afterwards and not trust him anymore. But I forgave him what he did because he apologized. And that's kind of how I work. But he was a real piece of work.
You mentioned that he would knock on your door.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get access to my room, and he was locked out of his room all day until like 8 o'clock. He'd get out. They'd throw you out at 7:30 for breakfast, and then you're out of your room until like 8 o'clock at night or something. Or 7:30 when it's time to take a shower. So me, I'm coming and going as I wish. And he's looking down the hall. He has nothing to do but walk down the hall, walk up, pace the ward, and get on the phone and curse his mother. One day when he was cursing his mother, he saw me going in and out of my room. So he comes knocking on my door. Hey, Issa, can I come in? Can I come in? And I made the mistake of once. Like, come on, Ralph, come on. And we talked music, and we talked art, and we talked whatever we talk, and talked about his family, talked about my family, whatever. And then he started coming back, more and more. See, now I'm in there, and he doesn't want to be on the ward. He wants to be in the crash pad with the TV and the videos and the music. So he just kept coming back. I said, Ralph, you're going to have to leave. What do you mean I got to leave? Why do you get to stay in here all day? I said, I don't know, Ralph. They let me stay. Well, why can't I get in my room? I don't know why you can't get in. Why can't I stay in here with you then? I Ralph, you're going to have to. Oh, I got to go. Huh? Okay, I hear that. Then go away. 10 minutes later, knocking on. Hey, Lisa, come on, come on. Ralph, can you keep it quiet? How do you mean keep it quiet? Why can't I be in there? What do you mean keep it quiet? Let me come in. So I got to let the guy in. He's going to disturb my cool and my chill. I got to sit with Ralph for like 2 hours now and babysit him. So he'd just blow up my spot, you know? So that was a real uncomfortable situation. The good thing, the kind of thing to put the stop to that is that one or two staff, maybe more than one staff, saw that he was coming there and coming in there, knocking on my door. And instead of saying, all right, both of you come out, which is what they usually do, or all right, Issa, you're going to have to come out. This is getting to be too much. They liked me so much and disliked him so much because he was a real pain in the ass. They said, Ralph, stay down the hall. Don't come down here knocking on this door. What do you mean? Why is he staying in his room? Don't worry why he's staying in his room, Ralph. You can't come in. So that kind of put the stops to that. And that kind of made him angrier. But that kind of put the stops out when they made him stay in the day room or stay down the hall and not come down the hall. Why can't I come down the hall? I got to walk. I'm only human. I got to walk down the hall. All right, you can walk down the hall, but you knock on that door. You're going in the seclusion room. Why am I going in the seclusion room now? Yeah, so they threatened him, and it worked. But for a while, he was blowing up my spot. As much as I knew they had my back, the staff, I also knew they turned on a dime. And at any moment, they could say, Issa, you got to come out of the room and we got to lock the door. So I was always on pins and needles and on eggshells about when they're going to throw me out of my room, even though I knew I had it like that. But you don't want to ever feel like you've got it like that too much because it could change. Or you don't want to ever feel like you can go in your room and sleep all day or jerk off or do whatever. So I was always on eggshells with that. I'd always go in my room and I'd lay down, but I wouldn't sleep. So that when they came in, they didn't have to rouse me and say, you're going to have to leave, and rouse me from a sleep because this nigga is in his room, sleeping in his room, and he should be outside type of thing. I mean, it was a weird kind of thing. I didn't ever relax. I didn't ever relax when I was in my room because I just felt like, don't trust them. Don't trust them. Don't ever feel too comfortable and feel like you own it. I've seen other guys who got really comfortable with it and were key holders like me. Key holders are people, trustees, or whenever they were too lazy, which is often like 99% of the time, and they're just behind the door and somebody needs to get in the room. Their job is to let people in and out of their rooms. Their job is to just, can I get in my room? Sure. Walk down the hall, open the door. You done? Okay. Lock the door, walk down the hall. That's their job. So they're too lazy. So, you know, whenever somebody needs to get in the room, hey, Issa, could you let this guy in his room? Hand me the keys. I'd let him run down the hall, let him in his room. I'd even say, if he's taking too much time, hey, taking too much time, could you hurry that up? Like I'd become a member of the staff. Yeah, could you hurry that up? You're taking too much time. What are you looking for? Can I help you look for it? Because you got to get out. I got the keys, and they want the keys back. That'd be my excuse. There'd be some of the other trustees would be like, come on, motherfucker, what you doing? Be like a real motherfucker trustee. But I'd be like, can I help you? Because I got the keys. I don't want to hold them too long. So can I help you look for what you're looking for? Can we move out? Can we kind of get this going? And I'd lock the door back when they're done and go back up the hall, give them the keys. But even being a key holder, I've seen other key holders get too comfortable and sleep in their room or watch porno or smoke when you weren't supposed to be smoking, just be smoking when it went smoke-free, or do God knows what, or just take liberties with the little bit of freedoms they give you. And they shut them down just to let them know who's boss, let them know you can't do that. I still own this space. So rather than feel that crush, I always kept myself in check and said, don't get too comfortable. Like in my mind, I just kept a mental note, don't get too. And it's a fucked up way to live, but that's just how, you know, just hedging your bets. I never bet the farm. And that's why I'm not a good gambler. And if I were to gamble, if I came away with anything more than what I came away with, I'm off that table and out the door. I'm not going to sit there and keep betting, you know. I can't do that. That's not me. I have to hedge my bets. I got to be really sure that's a sure thing or I won't play. And that was not a sure thing, knowing that you can go in your room, even though it was in its own way, because they loved the hell out of me because I was so humble. And I wasn't like those other motherfuckers who get too comfortable. So they loved me even more. So they'd let me go and stay there forever. And it wasn't even a situation after a while of come out, I change a shift. They'd knock, open the door, change a shift, you all right? Yeah, all right. Close the door and leave me in there. It wasn't like I had to come out for change of shift after a while and show your face. They'd check on me and then close the door. But I just didn't want to ever feel so comfortable where you get a motherfucker who he didn't get pussy last night, or his dog bit him, or something went wrong, or he lost money, and he wants to come in and fuck with whoever he can fuck with, and you are his next victim, and which I've seen happen. And I've actually been on the receiving end of that a few times. So that's why I've always kind of been very cautious about that, never took advantage of it too much, even though I was always in my room. Ooh. Ooh.
You mentioned something about Ralph had this amazing collection of porn.
Including pictures of my ex-girlfriend, Susan.
Who he was hot for.
He was hot for everybody. He was hot for the dog. He was hot for everything and everybody. He told me he couldn't come. He'd masturbate a lot and he'd get a little bit hard. And then he wouldn't come and he'd lose his erection because of the medication. He was about maybe in his early 50s when I knew him. But the medication he was on just robbed him of his sexual potency. But that still didn't mean he wouldn't try. So he amassed this collection of porn. Not only just like straight up porn, but like photographs of people, magazine clippings, whatever he could muster to masturbate over. And he just happened to acquire pictures of my ex-girlfriend when we were together. That weren't in the least bit. That weren't at all pornographic. She was fully clothed, maybe even overdressed. Turtleneck and winter coat outside. But if it had a pretty face, he was on it. You know, so.
What do you think his life was like before he was hospitalized?
Oh, I talked about it. He got sick and early. From what he told me, I don't want to tell. Well, since we're not using real names, I guess I can tell the story a little bit. He was a problem child. He wasn't terribly good in school. He was a bit slow, maybe even dyslexic or something like that. So he didn't do well in school. And his father gave him a real hard time. His father beat him and took him to task. His father was a real hard-nosed Italian-American, work hard, work ethic kind of guy. Working hard to give his family a place in Queens, like a lot of the working class families. And he spared no quarter. And he was tough on his older son. He beat him hard. He hit him hard. And he was easier on his second and baby son, who later became very, very, very famous and well-known, or at least respected. Went to school and got great jobs, but Ralph was always fell behind for whatever reasons. A lot of it may have had to do with the fact that he had it so hard from his father, and he had his mother's love. But in those kind of families, I don't want to start generalizing or stereotyping, but the father ruled the situation, the mother went along with whatever the father wanted, and she gave him a little bit of love whenever she could, but maybe in those families, the mother wasn't always there for the son when the son was catching hell from the father. You know what I mean? You've seen that. You know that. Especially in those tough-ass Italian-American families. And he caught the hard end of that. It damaged him. And then when he was a teenager, he was running the streets. And then he discovered LSD back in like the late 60s and pot and drugs, and that destroyed him. And then he became mentally ill as a result, or maybe as a concurrent with that. And he was... it was a problem ever since. Fun in his own way. I mean, one of those crazy guys in the neighborhood who unfortunately ends up in a mental hospital. But when they're in the neighborhood, they're the fun, most fun, craziest guys. Legendary stories of people like that in the neighborhood. But those people sometimes end up in a mental hospital or dead or in jail. And Ralph ended up in a mental hospital.
What do you think his dreams of how he wanted to be?
He wanted to be a singer, a rock star. He played instruments. He wasn't very good when I knew him, but he knew chords, little chords. He played saxophone. He wanted to be an artist. He was a very good artist. I think I mentioned to you before. With a lot of mentally ill, schizophrenic, obsessive, outside art, what's known as outside art, it gets so obsessive and so, I've noticed in a lot of it, it gets so obsessive that gets washed out, overdone, and kind of washed out. But his work, he always knew when to stop because he loved color. So he'd work with these vibrant colors and work it just enough so the colors stayed vibrant and didn't wash out or didn't get overdone. And I always admired that about his work.
What about the concepts behind it?
A lot of it was abstract. There were no concepts. I'm sure there were concepts, but it was mostly abstract that I saw him do. But the colors is what really impressed me about it, his color work. He loved bright, bright colors. Interesting colors, not just like yellows and reds, and but like fuchsias and periwinkles and just odd colors that would work well together. He had an interesting sense of color, which is very schizophrenic as well. It's like a trip, it's like an acid trip more so than schizophrenia. It's more like an acid trip, and it could have been what he was channeling because he took many trips in his life from what he said.
Yeah, you had some heart-to-heart talks with him.
I spent 5 years on a ward with him. So you would think, after all that time, and he liked my conversation because more often than not, I was the only conversation, the only relevant, the only coherent, non-tangential conversation to be had.
You mean the other guys on the ward?
Definitely you couldn't have it.
Low functioning, as you call it?
Not low functioning. No, there was low functioning in terms of MR, mental retardation, and just very, very basic, very, not even, just very, 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 very low functioning conversation. But there are other guys who were very intelligent, but it was all tangential. It was all just schizophrenic conversation. I mean, some of the smartest guys on the ward wouldn't make any sense. It would just be crazy conversation. So he was one of the few of, say, 30 guys on the ward, he was one of five who you could have a conversation with. But then he had mood or attitude problems, so you didn't really want to be around him too much. You could have a conversation, a good conversation with him, but he wasn't a nice guy. Well, he was a nice guy, but we didn't, personality conflicts. Isn't that always the way? The people you can talk to, you don't want to talk to. People you want to talk to, you can't talk to.
Any kind of things stand out, moments in... And did you guys play together?
He played my guitar, not only just with Peter Bernard Fingers, but there was one other time when he came in. He liked to break things. I don't know if he liked to, but he couldn't help. It was a compulsion, really. He broke things.
What do you mean?
He broke things. He ripped clothes. He broke Walkmans, Discmans. He broke shit. He broke stuff. He broke stuff. And I was in the visiting room many times with his family when they buy him all sorts of new stuff. And while he's in there trying it on, he ripped the shirt. Oh, gee, I ripped the shirt. Oh, God damn it, motherfucker. Cocksucker, I ripped the shirt. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Ma. I ripped the shirt. I'm only human. It wasn't good material anyway. I was testing it out, you know. I was testing it out to see if it would break, to see if it would rip, to see, because I don't want it to rip, you know. So I was testing it out just a little bit, and I just got carried away. I'm sorry, Ma. Bring another one. What else do you got? And put the other one on. Ah, shit, it ripped again. Maybe if you go to another store with better material, or maybe it's me, I don't know. I'm only human, Ma. I'd watch this. Just incredulous, because I got like six shirts to my name that I've been wearing for the last 10 years, and he's ripping up six shirts right in front of me from Ralph Lauren or God knows where they got them from. So I don't know. And this would happen on a regular basis, at least once a week. He'd go through this.
They'd bring him
clothes. He'd rip it in front of them. The ones he wouldn't rip in front of him, he'd take back to the ward and rip. He'd bring him a Walkman with tapes. He'd break the tapes. He'd break the Walkman. He'd insult his brother. What kind of shit music is this? And his brother would fight back. Wait, well, if you don't like it, fuck you if you don't like my music. Fuck you. No, fuck you. Back and forth, you know. And his brother would be, out of kindness of his heart, bring him a Walkman and bring some of his tapes. Or some of the tapes that he thought Ralph would remember from their childhood. Just things to kind of make a connection. And it would escalate into a fight. A scene out of Goodfellas or Raging Bull or something, you know, just crazy. And I'm sitting there eating my pizza with my girlfriend going, okay, well, all right, okay, do we leave? Do we stay? Do we go? You know.
This is in the...
In the visitor's room. Yeah.
It must have been pretty bizarre to watch.
It was very bizarre and very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable because I'm very good at trying to ignore stuff. But how do you ignore Raging Bull right in front of you? How do you ignore two brothers arguing about the pepperoni on the pizza? Or two brothers arguing about the music that he brought that the other guy doesn't like? That escalates into an almost near knockdown, drag-out fight. Or just like, how do you ignore that? You can't, but you do. Because Hey. And that the brother who's doing all this for him has notoriety, so you recognize him and you know him from wherever you watch TV or whatever. And how must he feel in that situation? How must he feel? You know? Or does he care that someone who not only recognizes you but as a fan cataloged some of your earliest work, which I did. I don't know if I made the mistake of doing that, but I was like, I saw you in 1984 in this movie that really blew my mind. You were a bit player, but you really... And it's the truth, because he's such a good actor that he takes bit... in the past, when he was just a bit player, he took bit roles and imbued them with such, like, humanity that it made an impression on me. And being a major media hound, it sticks with me. So I made the point of saying that. So you know he knows he's got a fan in there, so he's got a fan... you know, privy to this family drama, this family crisis, and it's just crazy. But you take it in stride, you know, because hey, I'm just a nigga, crazy nigga in a mental hospital. Basically, I'm not a fan who matters. I'm just some crazy nigga in a mental hospital with his girlfriend, his cute little girlfriend, while he's seeing his crazy brother. So I mean, that's how he could look at it, and maybe that's what helped him get through it. Not so much the nigger part, but just this guy's another patient. Where's he going with this information? So what? That's why when I saw him on the street that day I was with you, I didn't want to, like, say, hey, remember me, Ralph? Hey, you know, your brother Ralph? I was just like, I said to him, I had the opportunity to say in the business room and said many times, but I said to him on the street, man to man, you know, just like, hey, I really love your work. I think you're great. And I saw like a glimmer of recognition in his face for a second. But then he said, oh, yeah, thanks a lot. I saw that he knew me, and we interacted before, but he couldn't quite place it.
He said to me that he's not very good with names.
Yeah, recognition. Because he missed me thousands of people. But I saw in his face, you can tell when somebody is not just like getting an accolade and say thank you very much, but it's like there's a moment of I should know you kind of thing. And then I just was giving him the fanboy treatment. He just said thank you very much and moved on. But anyway, that's enough about him. We don't want to stay there too long.
Right. Now, talk to me a little bit about Ralph. What did he do during the day?
He messed in his pants. I made in my pants. I'm sorry, I'm only human. He'd pick it up. I made in my pants. I'm only human. And he'd walk up to you, you know, with a handful of shit. I'm only human. I made in my pants. I'm only human. I should clean it up, right? Yeah, Ralph. I think you should clean that up. I'm only human. He tried to smoke wherever he could. And he'd get on the phone and call his mother or his brother, predominantly, mainly his mother, and curse her out. Trying to get her to come up and visit him. He just hustled and used the phone as much as he could to get as many visits as he could. Because he was lonely and he needed his family support.
And when he was there...
He'd terrorize them.
And he terrorized you mentioned.
He terrorized everybody. He terrorized everybody. He was a terrorist. And he was the only terrorist, in the true sense of the word, but he was the only guy I can remember who would, after 9/11, which was a very hot time, where you could not say, I'm going to blow this building up when I get out. There were guys who would say that and be on the first bus to God knows where, and the black federal vans would come and pick them up downstairs. They'd be immediately bussed off to someplace else. But Ralph was the only guy, maybe because he had family notoriety, or maybe they just thought he was a nut and he got away with stuff, who would say, when I get out of here, I'm going to blow this place up, just like 9/11, just like the World Trade Centers. And they'd go, okay, Ralph, sit down. Sit down, Ralph. Dinner's almost ready. Sit down, Ralph. Sit down. Shut up, Ralph. Sit down. And you get away with it. The only guy I saw during that time, that hot time of 9/11 up until 2004, 2005, where you could not say that. You could not downgrade your president without being on a watch list. You remember those times. It was a scary time, but he got away with it. I don't know how, but maybe because he was saying it for so long before it happened that it just became part of his routine.
What were your conversations like?
We did have conversations. We would talk. We would just talk about mundane stuff. You asked how my girlfriend was. Tell me she's pretty. Boy, you're a lucky guy. I said, yeah, I guess I am. Then we talk about sex for a little while. Then we talk about his brother and what he's doing and acting-wise. And just mundane conversation, but not tangential. I mean, just clear conversation. He was sick, but not so sick, but not sick in a way where he couldn't have a conversation.
Was he aware of this concept of I'm only human? What does that mean?
What it meant to him, don't expect too much out of me, or don't shun and push me out because I shit in my pants, or because I do something that may be untoward or distasteful, because I'm only human. I'm sick. He'd say, I'm sick. I'm sick. I'm a sick man. I'm a sick man. I'm only human. I'm only human. That's what he'd say. And then he'd punch somebody in the face or something, or he'd do something that would, you know, that would be his precursor, his prefix and suffix to some bad behavior. I'm sick, I'm a sick man, I'm only human. And then in between that, he'd do something that would just blow your mind, disgusting or uncomfortable or inappropriate.
Did he know what he was doing?
That's a good, you know, that's something for only Ralph to answer. I don't know. Some say he does, some say he doesn't. And depending on what side of the fence you fall on, there are a lot of people who fall on the side of the fence of some people are mentally ill, and a lot of people are just playing crazy. And those people who would say that he knew exactly what he was doing. There are people who would definitely think that because it was so spiteful and so well thought out, some of his terrorism. And so just unbelievably cruel and nasty and just... And other times... But when you see it with such regularity, it makes you wonder, is this a part of his illness? This must be, is this his illness? Yeah? Or is he just like so angry that he's locked up in a mental hospital and this is the place where he can do that kind of thing, so let me do it. Not give a fuck. Let me not give a fuck because I'm locked up. My family left me in a mental hospital and I have no life and no future. So fuck all. And he carried on accordingly. So it could be a question of that. And then, but just to prevent himself from getting locked in the seclusion room, his answer would be, "Wow, why'd you do that? I'm a sick man. I'm a sick man. I'm only human." You know, he'd say, "Okay, Ralph, go sit down in the back."
Had you seen him in the seclusion room?
Yeah, many times. They had a system where they had checks, where if they checked, put a check next to your name, and if you got more than three checks, you wouldn't go out to program the next day. So he'd act up, of course, and get a check. And then he'd act up again, get another check. And then he'd act up again. Did I get a check? Did you check my name? Just tell me if I got a check. Let me know if I got a check. Did I get a check? Did I get a check? Let me know if I got a check. Motherfucker, cocksucker. Cocksucker, let me know if I got a fucking check, cocksucker. Just let me know. Just let me know. And they wouldn't tell him. You know, so.
They wouldn't tell him.
So, you know, it would be a whole thing.
Someone mentioned that he'd go around saying, I'm Ralph, I'm Ralph, I'm Ralph.
Yeah, that was one of his many. Yeah, he had a whole...
What other little kind of?
He just. I'm telling. I can't remember all of them. I've tried to forget. Once I got out 3.5 years ago, I washed all that shit off my back, including Ralph and many, 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 many others, many, 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 many others, and just only remember the good times. If you could even imagine.
Really.
Recording my music in the bathroom, painting paintings in my room, or in the laundry room. For hours and not being undisturbed and coming up with really good pieces. The nice times I spent with friends in the visitor's room, Susan and others. The few patients that really made a difference, that were really kind and sweet and nice, like my roommate. The good times we had. The good conversations we had. The quiet moments. The quiet moments. That's what I hold on to. Not that I hold on to, but that if I remember anything, that's what I remember. And those will fade as well. But all that bad shit, like Ralph, I haven't thought about it since you brought it up today. And then decided, well, let's tape some of this.
Right.
I hadn't thought about him. That was gone. That was gone. Now you brought it up. Now I'm going to dream about this stuff, too, probably tonight.
Well, Ralph seems like a character.
He was a character. He was
out of some sort of surreal.
He said he was a better actor than his brother, and he probably was. He probably was. He probably was a better actor than both his brothers. He was amazing. He was quite a character. I mean, his one brother who's an exceptionally good, he's had another brother who's a good actor, but his one brother is like an exceptionally good actor. I mean, a phenomenally talented man who's now also a director. But he's channels things, but he's very technique also. He's very in the moment, but there's a lot of technique that he's learned and so forth. But Ralph is just pure, raw, Bobby De Niro, just go for broke. You know, he's funny, he's off the cuff, he's scary when he wants to be, like Joe Pesci. You know, he's a real piece of work, that guy.
How do you think he saw himself?
I don't know. I don't like, but you always ask that question. I don't know. I'm just trying to get through life myself, trying to see myself through life. You always ask, how do you think he saw himself? I don't know. I have no idea about that. I don't think about that.
I mean,
I don't think about that question, so let's move on. I don't think about how people see themselves. I don't think about that. I'm too busy trying to work through my own life and since how I see myself than to worry about how other people see themselves.
He must have been angry at something.
His father, maybe. His mother for allowing this to happen. Himself, his brothers, life. Of course he was angry. I think I mentioned that. So, of course he was angry. He was very angry. His life didn't turn out. That maybe he never had a dream, and whatever the dreams he had were so far flung that he couldn't really realize them. And then not only couldn't he realize them, but he's in a mental hospital for 5 years. Not that you don't, I mean, there's been enough people who walk around the streets free who hadn't realized their dreams. But to not realize your dreams and end up in a nut house for 5 years? What kind of descent is that? So of course he's going to be angry. I was angry for many years. But then I realized, you know, don't be angry. Make it better. And I was able to do that. Don't ask me. I don't know how I was able to do that, but I was. I was able to write songs, teach myself how to write songs, channel my father or whatever, and start writing songs. And then, well, let me start recording them. And I started recording them, and they were halfway decent. Demos, at least. And, of course, I could paint my ass off, so that always kept me going. So I had something. I had a little bit of something. I had a little bit more than most people, and I consider myself very fortunate for that.
Go back to something you mentioned earlier in an earlier conversation about being in the laundry room in the control tower. What do you call that?
In the captain's quarters.
The captain's quarters.
The laundry room was where you steered the ship.
Right.
When it took off. Because you had the dials and you had to put the water in and then the solution, the engine fluid, that would mix, the gasoline would mix with the water and as it goes around and then you turn the engine over and turn the dryers would be turning the engine before you know it, you're airborne.
and Ralph would come in.
Ralph would come in and bother me.
When you were steering the ship?
When I was steering the ship, Ralph, you gotta leave. What do you mean I gotta leave? Cocksucker, motherfucker! How do you get to stay in the laundry room? What the fuck is going on, Ralph? You're gonna have to leave. What do you mean I gotta leave? Oh, come on.
And how would you get rid of him?
He'd always make such a ruckus that the staff would come in and take him out. And they'd say, Issa, what are you doing here? I'm doing the laundry. Do you mind? Okay. But keep Ralph out of here. I said, oh, if you keep him out of here, that'd be... Oh, I'll keep him out of here. Good, thanks. Should I lock it behind you? No, don't lock it behind me, but just keep Ralph out. Okay. Cocksucker! As he's being dragged out.
And did he ever go through a code 3 or something like that?
Code green?
Code green?
Plenty. He was always escalating. Then he wouldn't go out for the next day and be upset and rage and rant and stew.
So you're in the control room.
Captain's quarters.
The captain's quarters.
Which was also the engine room.
The engine room. And what are you doing?
I'm steering the ship. I'm piloting the spaceship. The building was a huge spaceship that would rise up out of the ground, turn around, upend itself, because we were upside down in it. So once it rose up, it upended, and the bottom became the top, and then it would float up into the cosmos, like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Did Ralph see you when you were dressed in your...
I was usually naked when I was doing all that, when I was piloting the ship.
Oh, really?
I that usually happened like at 2 and 3 in the morning, you know. I do the laundry and get the coordinates ready and turn the engine on. And once I realized that we were airborne and I passed a certain stratosphere is when I'd get naked because it would get really hot. And then I'd just get naked and just relax. And back when I was smoking marijuana, I'd smoke a joint naked. Or smoke whatever I could smoke, besides crack, like a cigarette or a joint. I just kind of sit there naked, looking out the window, and sit on the windowsill, smoking. It was very relaxing. Very relaxing.
Steering the ship.
Steering the ship. Letting the ship, kind of like on autopilot. Just kind of like being like getting, when you've got like a good distance and you're on autopilot, like you're on a freeway kind of, and you just kind of like, okay, we're airborne, okay, coordinates set, okay, I can relax. Just kind of. Relax and chill for a moment. Smoke.
Where'd you get these? How did you come by this stuff?
With the marijuana or the cigarettes?
Yeah, the marijuana.
You can get anything if you want it. And I was actually such a nice guy to the guys who were the dealers, because it was my job to be in the laundry room to do the laundry. That was my job at that time on the ward. I volunteered. It wasn't my job. I volunteered to do the laundry for the ward. So the staff let me stay in there. And then the dealers would come in and do their dealing and kind of collect up their money and separate their stash or whatever. And the only place they could do it safely was in the laundry room. And I'd let them stay and do that for a while. So they'd hit me off with a joint or a bag. I said, thanks. Yeah. That's back when I was smoking. But then I smoked too much and got sick and flipped out after a while.
You flipped out yourself?
I flipped out, yeah.
And what was that like?
I crashed a spaceship. I flipped out.
Jesus Christ.
I crashed a fucking spaceship.
How could you do that?
Because I was high, man. DWI. DWI. Driving while intoxicated. Driving while under the influence.
That spaceship.
That was a big fucking spaceship. That's
no,
a 17-story
I was
spaceship.
In it.
That was a 17-story spaceship.
Right. So you crashed the spaceship.
And then the staff came in. Whoop, 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 whoop. Captain, what's going on? Captain, what's going on? Oh, no, the captain, something's happened to the captain. Click, get him. They're holding me down. I'm smeared and shit. Oh, God, he's got shit all over. What happened? Oh, do I got to touch him? Oh, get me some gloves. They're holding me down. They're juicing me up. Stab him, quick, get him. Get a needle in him. Oh, we got to save him. I'm panicking. Ah. Yeah, you know. It was crazy. It was crazy.
I can imagine. And how many times did you do that?
Just once on marijuana. But I've had subsequent flip outs where I'd go back to the captain's quarters. I'd go back to the laundry room. I've had two other instances, once while high on marijuana and two other times when I came off the medication. Once when the doctor took me off because she thought I was, my psychiatrist thought I was, my diagnosis at the time was drug-induced psychosis. And she was convinced that, oh, it's only because of the drugs. And I can tell right now that if I took you off these psychotropics, you'd be right as rain. So I'm taking you off your psychotropic meds and good luck to you. And 7 months later, I flipped out. And I was back in the laundry room. And then another time, the last time I flipped out is when shit was going wrong and they were handling my case really fucked up and something went wrong again with when you're there long enough, shit's going to go wrong. Shit's just going to go wrong. And I was so upset and I had no recourse. There was nothing I can do. So I was so angry. I said, I'm not taking this medication anymore. That was the only thing I could do to rebel. So I said, I'm not taking your fucking medication. I didn't tell them that, but I just kind of started spitting it out and I eventually flipped out again. And then I was so sick that they said, no, we're going to put you on medication over objection. We're going to take you to court. What do you think about that? And he said, you have to find me first.
To find you? Yeah. What do you mean?
I don't know what that means.
You were on the ward. You were locked down. I have to find you. They knew exactly where you were.
I don't know what that means, but that's what I said. I thought I could turn invisible. I had superpowers at the time. I was so crazy, I thought I had superpowers, and one of my superpowers was invisibility. So I said that to the doctor. You have to find me first. And he's like, okay.
What's that? Twilight Zone.
Yeah. So, okay, you can leave now. It's okay. See you in court. Or maybe you won't. Yeah. And so
talk to me a little bit about being invisible. Did it work?
I thought it did.
Did you have a special?
No, I just go to the mirror and go superstar. I say superstar three. That was my name as a superhero, superstar, like Jesus Christ superstar. That's how I came up with it. And because I was Jesus Christ, but I was like a 21st century Jesus Christ. I was superstar. When Jesus comes back, he's not going to be Jesus Christ, a carpenter in sandals. He's going to be a fucking superhero. So I assumed this was me, you know. So I go to mirror, superstar. And I say, okay, I'm invisible, I guess. And I'd walk around and walk through the hall, and I'd go, boo, and to somebody. They'd ignore me. So, okay, good, I'm invisible.
With clothes on or without clothes on?
Sometimes with clothes on. I'd take my clothes off and I'd walk around. But then I came to think, after a while, walking around with no clothes, I'd walk for a period and okay, I'm invisible, I'm totally naked. But there were certain quadrants that once you entered, you'd become visible again on the ward. Because it was kind of like different quadrants, different dimensions. And if you stayed in a certain dimension, you'd be invisible. But once you pass a certain dimension, like walk into the day room naked, or walk past the chart room where the psychiatrist sat, he had the power to see if from his office, from his false glass, from his window, that all invisible people. So when I'd walk past that window, I see him freak out. Put some clothes on! Hey, get him! I said, damn! You know, I figured out not to walk past that window naked, because he'd see me. So, but other times, it was tricky. But it was tricky. I was always trying to figure it out, because I was in the demon's realm. So you had to. It wasn't just like being on the street. I kept telling myself, if I were on the street, I'd be unstoppable. I'd be superstar. I'd be invisible. I'd be flying, laser beam out of my eyes. I'd be incredible. But this place is evil. It's my spaceship, but it's been taken over by evil. The devil also lives here, and he's using some of his powers. And he's a strong motherfucker. So it's like I don't have total power here. So it's like some of my crew are with me, some of my crew are with him. It's a chess game between me and the devil, and I got to figure this shit out. That's what it's all about.
And did you figure it out?
That was the task. Whenever I got sick, to figure it out, to play the game and win, to play the chess game with Satan and win, which later became the Cosmic Knockout, where I just flipped the fuck out and go totally out of my mind. But every time I got sick, for a month or 2 months, I'd sit in a chair in the day room, and with a one-to-one aide next to me, because by this time I'm on one-to-one, and I'm watching the TV, and I'm watching the people walk back and forth, because they all walked in the day room.
Oh, people are always walking?
Always walking, constantly walking.
They can't sit down.
Why is that? Many can't sit down. Some will sit down and watch TV if they're tired, but there's a lot of movement, a lot of activity. And they were doing the battle for me. When one would walk in front of me to try to attack, someone else would come across and try to attack. One of mine would neutralize. And that's what it was all day.
So you're sitting in there in the day room. What's going through your mind?
The chess game. If I'm trying to relax, I'm trying to think, okay, Terrence, block him. He's one of the bad guys. Block him. Okay, come back. Oh, no, okay. Danny, block him, Danny, block him. Ronnie, block him, Ronnie, block him. Hit him, go ahead. Yeah. Richie, get him, Richie.
Was Ralph in there at two?
Ralph, not at one of those times. He wasn't, he would have been a real Satan disciple. He would have been a real minion of Satan, boy, if he were.
So you're playing this chess game, and you're on one-to-one.
With the devil. And across from me is the devil box, is the television. So the Satan is in the television, playing against me. And he's programming his people through the television, and also, like, throwing up commercials and little tuneful things making fun of me, commercials that would televise the game in tuneful little 30-second spots, or in the news. You'd watch the news and you get kind of try to figure out through the subspeak of the news and the subspeak of the commercials and the subspeak of television who's winning, who's losing, what the and it'd be an hours long game. And then at the end, okay, time to go to bed. Okay, better luck next time. Tomorrow, okay, tomorrow we're gonna kick his ass. Tomorrow we're gonna kick his ass. Okay, guys, we're gonna kick his ass. Okay, and the guy went to an aide. What you saying? Whose ass you gonna kick? Oh, nothing. I'm just talking to myself. Yeah, all right. You're not kicking nobody's ass, he said. All right.
And you're going through this gymnastics in your mind. You're in the day room. Talk to me about this subspeak.
Well, it's regular speech, but when you're sick, it takes on ideas of reference. You think what everybody is saying is referential to you, and in my case, in a very negative way, even though it's not. So you may catch a glimpse of something that's saying you're an asshole, or sounds like you're an asshole. Buy some gas today. What? Who's an ass today? What? You know, or any things like that. And that's a very simple one. That's a no-brainer. But there are other things that you listen to and try to figure out what's going on. Who's going to die at 12 o'clock tomorrow? What? And then something else will hit you and trying to decipher that. So you spend all day trying to decipher every sentence that comes out of every sentence that comes out of somebody's mouth. Then you got to decipher the song that's being played and why that's being played, and then what they're selling. And then, welcome back to so-and-so. Who's this guy? What does he mean? Is he me or is he him? Is he a stand-in for me or is he standing for him? Who is this guy? What does that mean? And you're just like computing all day. Computing and trying to collect all of this data into some kind of semblance of something that makes sense, that into the overall scheme of it's the end of the world and you got to save it, basically. That's the theme of the show, of your life, of what's going on. And everything that's going on is all parts of a puzzle that click into that, and how you can maybe do it if you put it all together. And that was my job as savior of the earth.
As super stud?
Superstar.
Superstar.
I was only super stud when I was fucking.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, the nurse or whatever girlfriend I was seeing who was coming up at the time. And if I was sick, I'd go in there with a sheet and nothing underneath. And we'd get busy. And they'd be screaming in the day room. And people would be at the little window looking in, laughing, watching, collecting. And then I got smart enough to paper over for the young lady's modesty. I'd paper over the window.
In the day room.
Little 3-inch porthole in the window so that they wouldn't see what was going on. But there were a couple of times I just walk in, get busy, and walk out. Or get busy and stay in the visit, and people were watching, and then I had the whole visit, and then walk in and walk out without papering over the window.
And how was that?
I didn't care. I was sick.
What's it like to be sick?
I'm telling you. Okay, now imagine this, what I'm saying, and try to imagine it and have no control over it. The good and the bad. So your highs are outrageous and your lows are devastating. The orgasms and the sex was amazing because I was lean and cut because I wasn't eating. And when I was eating, it was really good, really like fine foods. And I was exercising, working out like a fiend because I'm about to save the earth. I got to be a superstar. I got to be a superhero. So I'm working out. I was in the best shape of my life. And then all of a sudden someone comes up and wants to have sex. And I just stride right in and fuck the shit out of them for hours, you know.
In the day room.
In the day room. No, not in the day room. In the visitor's room.
Oh, what do you mean in the visitor's room?
In the visitor's room. That's where the visitors would come.
Wait a second. So there's people all over the place in the visitor's room.
No, only if you have a visitor do you get a visitor's room. But if they have a porthole in the visitor's room door where people could look in and see just like a corner of the visitor's room. So I would usually go to another corner where you couldn't see, but sometimes I'd drag it out into the middle of the room on the table, and then you could see.
Would you be the only one in the room?
Me and my visitor.
Oh,
usually we worked it out, my girlfriends, all my various girlfriends, where they knew what times to come. like the 6:30 to 7:30 period in the evening, where no one would ever come. And certain times on during the week, from 3:30 to 5, no one would come, except me and her.
Ba-dum-bum-psh.
But those times were always good. But during the weekends, people would be in the business. And sometimes I was getting jerked off while people were in there, which I'm not proud of. I feel real bad saying that right now, but it was what it was.
Well, you were describing a time when you were... Now, you were talking about... You're not
That's when I was sick. Yeah, but there are other times where we utilized the visitor's room for sex where I wasn't sick. And I just happened to have a girlfriend at the time, either someone who I was with for many, many years or someone who I'd met who wanted to get busy and wanted to have some of that great I've been locked up sex, as one young lady called it, Rebecca. I'm having some great I've been locked up sex with you. And I was like, okay, whatever. Can't wait till you get out so I can have some great just been locked up and we just got out sex. And I was like, well, I don't know if you're going to get any of that. And she never did get any of that. But she did get some great I've been locked up sex.
Well, talk to me a little bit about sex and mental...
Well, it's a primal thing. And when you get sick, it's very intense. It's You're an animal. You're an animal. And I'd come out of there in white, long white T-shirts spattered with blood and feces and cum. And the Mahatma's going good, Aza. Going good, right? Going good. Give me the thumbs up and push, right? Push, right? Yeah, okay, whatever. Because they knew. Everybody knew. How I got away with it, I'll never know. Nobody else got away with it. They really gave me a lot of, leeway, I swear to God. They gave me a lot of leeway. A lot of people live vicariously through my shit. You know? And a lot of people also realize I did a terrible thing to get there and I probably would never get out. So a lot of them really just figured, let the nigga go. Let this guy get whatever he can get because he ain't never getting out of here. And 20 years afterwards, it seemed that way. So I could see where a lot of them really thought, what the fuck? Let him get his, you know?
Talk to me a little bit about, so you're in there for 10 years, and you're bugging out. Bugging out. And then all of a sudden you get this injection. Medication over, what was that about?
What do you mean, what was that about? What do you mean, do I have to go through that whole story?
No, I'm just saying is that...
Your life changes. You have your sanity back. Very quickly, too, as a matter of fact.
I
got a shot. Whereas the other times I was remedicated, it took like a month, maybe a month and a half, for the medication to take, to re-up again. And you're unsteady. Not to say I wasn't unsteady after getting the shot, but like immediately. Like, I got my first shot, and like hours later, boom, I'm thinking straight. I'm not crazy anymore. And I was like, what? And the first thing you feel, I thought, was, my God, what the fuck happened to me? I was crazy. I'm crazy. I did all that stuff. And I got this shot, and now I feel straight again. My God, this stuff really works. I'm really crazy. I need medication. I better not fuck with this. And there was an epiphany. It was a pivotal moment in my life. It was a pivotal moment. Because I'd flipped out before on pot and flipped out before because I stopped taking off my medication and didn't put the pieces together. But because it was so almost instantaneous after a couple of hours, I was like, wow. So,
What gave you that sense?
It was insight. It was just having your mind straight and straight enough to know why I need medication. It was just what I described.
Yeah, no, I know. But what I'm just saying is that all of a sudden... You got your mind back, and you're reflecting on 5 minutes before that. You were
not 5 minutes, but a couple hours.
A couple hours. You were out of your.
I think I may have gone to sleep. I think I got the shot, and took a nap. And 4, 5, 6 hours later, I wake up. It was the next day or whatever. And it's like you know the difference between sanity and insanity. If you've never experienced it, God bless you. I hope you never do. But those who have, they know the difference between sanity and insanity. Or maybe that's wrong, because there are a lot of people who think they're sane and they're not. So that's even a strange thing to say. But I know the difference between sanity and insanity. And I've also been crazy and not know I was crazy. But once you've passed that, gone over that line, you know when you're back over the line again. When you're back into sanity after being in. And so it just, I guess I gained insight. Something a lot of people don't have, a lot of mentally ill people don't have. For a long time, I didn't have. But I gained it at that instant. And it was a profound shift for me. And I hold true to it. I hold on to it for dear life. I hope I always will know. I hope I always will remember and know the difference.
Now, it said that sometimes the meds affect your creativity and your imagination.
Who said that?
I don't know.
But did I ever say that?
I think so.
I don't know if I ever said that.
We once saw somebody who was kind of...
I mean, you know, you create differently when you're insane than when you're not. Myself is very technically proficient. I don't think I'd be able to do if I were insane. Myself is very loose and very visionary and interesting in its own way when I'm sick. Very heavily worked. I wish I gave a piece, one of a few, I gave a most, I know you're going to say what you're going to say, but don't say it. I rescued a piece. But there's some pieces I've done that were really, when I was far out there, and I gave one to this one young lady, one woman who was a director of one of the programs I was at, and I wish I hadn't because it was brilliant. I wish I hadn't given it to her, but it was like a piece that I worked hard and overworked to a degree, but not to the point where it became mud on the canvas. It was just worked enough. And it was great. And she got it. But it's a totally different thing. It's like right brain, left brain. It's like two totally different people, almost. Like two totally different types of work. But there's a certain technical proficiency that I have when I'm straight that I would never have when I'm sick. So I wouldn't say that my work has suffered at all now that I'm medicated. It's actually been much better in a certain way. You know, but there's some people who say they can't work when they're on medication. Maybe it's true. I don't know. You ask me questions I can't answer. You may talk to them and get their opinion. But I don't know. For me, it's two totally different animals because it's two totally different animals. It's a sick person and a well person.
But when you're sick, you don't... Do you know you're sick?
I don't. A lot of people don't.
So that's the inside of Ralph. Ralph would go and
I don't know if he uses that as an excuse, though. I don't know. I can't really talk about Ralph. I can't really talk about only the things that he says and if he means what he says. I don't. There are some people who really do know when they get sick. There's one person, who a brilliant artist, who knows, who just has tremendous insight. But he's like in his early 40s, late 30s, early 40s. So you would think by now, after 20 years of living on the bridges, not that I'm not talking about that person, but he's had similar experiences, living on the bridges and dodging cars on the highway and taking every drug under the sun. You would think by the time you're in late 30s, early 40s, and you've been through all that, you'd have some degree of insight where you know when you're sick and you know it's better to stay well and you stay on your meds and you talk to your psychiatrist and you talk to your treatment team and blah, blah, blah.
So going back to that moment where you woke up and realized, wow, how did you... What was your steps? What did you do next?
I was recovering for a year, actually, after that. I didn't paint anything for a whole year. Anything.
While you were on your...
In 1998. From 1998 to maybe May or June of 1999. From June of 1998, when I first got the shot. And then, like, all of 98 previous, all of that, those 6 months previous, and perhaps a month or so... Into late 1997, I didn't paint. I didn't draw. I didn't write music. I wrote some songs. Actually, I wrote a rock opera, which I got lost. Great songs. But I didn't paint anything. And then after getting the shot, I didn't paint anything. I listened to this one program that had a radio preacher on it. And I didn't understand a word he was saying because my brain hadn't totally clicked in yet, but I liked the sound of his voice. It was very calming, so I would end up listening to the sound of his voice just to be soothed. I realized that now. I didn't realize that for a while, but I thought I was just listening to the program because it was like, okay, it's religious, and maybe I should embrace God. I didn't understand what he was saying, and I wasn't really paying attention to any of the religiosity. This happened to be a preacher's program that I found on the dial, and I just tuned into it, and I found his voice and stayed there. And ended up listening to it every night at the same time before I went to bed. But yeah, I was kind of like in a chrysalis state. I didn't paint. I was kind of rebooting, getting pulling it together slowly for about a year. I remember the first painting I did after the experience, and it's kind of schizophrenic. It's kind of crazy. And it's one of the few I have still that doesn't make any sense, and yet it's cohesive in other ways.
Have I seen it?
I could show it to you at some point. Or I may have a picture of it. It's in the Cosmic Knockout.
You told me a story a long time ago about kind of went around and you apologized after.
Well, yeah, immediately after the shot, like maybe a week after I got the shot, and I was sent back to the ward after from being on secure unit for like 6 months. I just wrote memos. I saw people who I disrespected, women who I exposed myself to, guys who I started fights with, or staff members who I disrespected. And I just went up to them and said, "I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was sick, or as sick as I was. And I said a lot of things that really messed up. I think I may have said something to you that kind of might have been uncool. I'm sorry about that." And they say, "It's okay, man. We know where you're at. You gotta know where you're at. We knew where you were. You didn't know where you were. You're in a psych ward. And so we take all that in stride. And I've had worse happen, so it's no problem. And you're actually a decent guy to come up and apologize for us. So that's really cool. So we're still cool, right?" And I said, "Yeah, thanks. Okay, good." So they'd be very good about it. And some of the other people who I didn't have immediate access to, like some of the unit chiefs and some of the upper echelon, the deputy directors, this one woman who I exposed myself to, who was a deputy director. She called me into the visitor's room. I thought for sure I was going to get pussy from this 60-year-old Korean lady. And I mean, why else would she be calling me into the visitor's room? You know? And it's a joke. And so I just go in there and whip that shit out. "Oh, you're going to have to leave. You're going to have to leave." I was like, "Damn, what happened? Was I not hard enough? What the fuck was that all about?" Then I get a shot. You know, I get tied down or something. "What the fuck is going on? That was a shoo-in." So I sent a little note and put it in the interior mail to her. She got it and she said, I got your note. And, I appreciate that. And we'll start again, okay? We'll start." They always say that, psychiatrists. "We'll start again, okay? We'll start again.
We'll start again," with that voice.
Yeah, just like that. "We'll start again. We'll medicate your ass and see if we can turn you into something other than what you were when you came here."
But from that moment on, when you got your shot, you were...
I'd started again, and I'm still on that path. I'm still on that
path. No meltdowns?
No meltdowns. And I've been stressed out from time to time, and came down, like when I was out of the hospital, I came down from like 150 milligrams to 125, and there were things happening at that time that I have to admit, my girlfriend at the time precipitated, and other things were precipitating, and I just got stressed out. I didn't get sick, but I knew myself enough to know, wow, this is not a good feeling. Let me bump up 25, go back up to my maintenance dose. I've done that, and I've been fine ever since. Even things are stressful, I'm handling like a champ. Comic-Con, handling it like a champ. Yeah, this is my maintenance dose. I'm sticking with it.
So you, looking back at where you've been, how do you make sense of that?
It's just a life. There's so many people who have lives, lead lives, who take them to wherever it takes them. And this is just where my life has taken me. That's all. I'm no special. I'm no different than anybody else. If I can do something with this experience and help others and kind of make a difference with it, then that makes it a little more special or a little more interesting or a little more, special, I suppose. But I hate to say special, but, you know. But otherwise, there's nothing. My life is just like anybody else's. Yeah.
20 years in.
You spent 20 years in a marriage, didn't you? You spent 20 years in California. That's just like a mental hospital, trust me.
Trust me, I was a mental hospital.
Okay.
Marriage for some is a mental hospital.
Exactly. You've been married twice.
Yeah, I didn't know better. So, I still don't know better.
So you had a case of you had a case of recidivism there. You went back in. They went and got you twice.
Well, yeah, but I'm hardwired to do that, to be mentally ill.
Yeah, well, I've
yeah, it's called it's in my genes.
I've
it's
cut
in my
short
5,000 million billion quadrillion years.
I've cut short my hard wiring. I've cut short my hard wiring. I've rewired myself. Thank God. Thank God.
Now, when you see other people, let's tie in our psychophobia. So you see other people; they're sick. Their minds are sick. Do you have psychophobia?
To a degree, meaning, but mine might be different. Some people have psychophobia because they don't want to be around mentally ill people because it's dirty and it's crazy and it's whatever it is. It's the stigma that they have about it that might be catching, or that it's a remembrance of their family and it's a bad memory, or it's just like not, it's abnormal. They don't want to be around something that's abnormal. I just have memory of it because I spent 20 years around it, and that's enough. That's enough, thank you. So when I see it, it's like, okay, I see this guy, I feel for him. Wow, he's going through hell. He's on the streets, and he's definitely schizophrenic, or he's hearing voices. And I just keep stepping because, you know, my peer counselor hat, I don't wear it all the time, my peer counselor cape. I wear my peer counselor cape at work, but when I'm walking down the street and I'm trying to get somewhere, I'm wearing my Clark Kent outfit, and my cape does not show.
Are you still a superstar?
you know what I mean. I mean, I'm a peer counselor, and I help people out when I'm at the job, or if I just happen to be somewhere and I can help. And I try to help when I can, but there are other times when it's like, you know, when someone's begging you on the street who isn't mentally ill but just homeless and hungry, but you gotta be somewhere in 5 minutes ago, and this guy's in your way, you're going to sidestep and say, sorry, I saw you today when somebody was begging. You just ignored them. With me, I never ignore them. I say, I'm sorry, I can't. You engage them and say, I'm talking to you, yes, but I'm not offering you anything. Or the only thing I can offer is to say, I can't help you, and I'm sorry, but good luck to you. But you, as a fucking New Yorker, is like, you just ignored the fucking guy and walked by him. That's how I feel about the mental illness. There are times when I can stop and times when I can help. And there are other times when I see it and I'm on the subway and someone's bugging out and it's like, oh, God, when's my stop coming up? You know, is this guy going to come sit next to me or near me and start this shit? You know? So there are times when I'm up for it and other times when I can do without it. And it only comes from the fact that I've been around it so long, and there are times when you don't want to be around it. That's why I was so lucky when I was in a hospital and locked up around it and surrounded by it to be able to go in my room. And chill, you know. Had I not had that, I don't know what kind of person I'd be. Had I not been able to go into my room and when somebody's bugging out, or even when somebody wasn't bugging out, but just to not be in that environment, and just start a painting. Wow, look at that! Maybe if I start, you know, just put a raw canvas on my wall and start a painting, or pull out my guitar and start a song and have it be a good one that I later start to demo into the night. You know, I mean, that's a godsend. So I'm very blessed. I'm very blessed to have had the support that I had while in there, and the support of myself, and just afforded the fortitude, the personal fortitude to stay sane, to stay healthy.
Well, just for information. That guy who
you don't have to do it. No, you don't have to do it.
No,
you feel on the spot.
No, I need to explain something.
You don't have to explain that.
Yeah, no, I do.
You want to be the good guy.
No,
you don't want to come off. You don't want to come off bad.
No,
that's
no.
Uncool.
No,
that's
no.
Uncool.
No,
because I saw what the exchange was. So to talk about it in hindsight on tape just to make yourself look better isn't cool.
Okay,
let it sit.
I would agree with
let
that.
Let it sit.
But that's not true. I've seen that guy around. A lot of these guys who walk around with canes and with wheelchairs.
Like the mentally ill. Like the mentally ill, right? No, they're faking it.
No, there are guys. I know a bunch of these guys who are in wheelchairs, and you see them running down the street 10 minutes later.
All right.
So, I mean, I'm a fucking New Yorker, but I'm suspicious of when I see people playing with a cane, with this and that, I say to myself, this guy is, he doesn't care who it is, I'm just a mark, and I don't like that sense of it. So I heard you respond. I just walk right by because I don't have tolerance for, there's so many people in the city who are conning you. I don't have, and I've been conned, I've gone for it. So I just wanted to stand up and say, I didn't believe that guy was anything other than just out there with his cane, looking like somebody who needed money, which you and I don't have at the moment to spare. And with that, what do you say about that, mister?
You've washed your hands. Okay. Hands are very clean now.
No, they're not clean. I'm just saying there are times where I...
There's a little bit of blood in the fingernails, but otherwise your hands are very clean.
Oh, low blow.
Otherwise your hands are very clean. So we can wrap this up.
We can wrap this up. You want to give us a little...
no, I don't.
You can get the lele, since I've never heard you play the guitar, and this is part of a birthday gift that somehow wound up in your hands.
Yeah. This is part of a birthday gift that wound up in your hands. Walk past the beggar with the cane in his hand. Chain me to the radiator with a guitar lele in my hand. Record my deepest thoughts with a recorder in your hand. But I wonder, yes, I wonder, how do you feel? With that recorder in your hand, how do you feel? That recorder in your hand, how do you feel? With that recorder in your hand, how do you feel? Let me hand it to you, brother.